Going Linux, episode 221, Open Source Licenses, an Introduction. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Bill. Whether you're new to Linux, upgrading to Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in going Linux.
We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done.
In today's episode, Open Source Licenses, an Intro. Hey Larry, how you doing today?
Wonderful. We've been trying to get the computer gods to cooperate with us and bless our recording here, but it doesn't seem to be working much today. We'll power through, though.
Yeah, we're having a little bit of technical difficulties. Thank you. Of course, we had everything set up last night, and look what happens.
Yes. Well, that's the penalty you pay for being too prepared, I guess.
Are you sure that Tom ain't back there turning them bolts again?
I'm not so sure about that. I don't know. Okay.
Well, hey, Larry, I was, as I like to say, crawling the internet, intertubes, as Tom used to say, and I found a great site for up-to-date Linux news, and it's called Linux Today.
I know that site. Yes, absolutely. I get a lot of my Linux news off of that site.
Yeah, and what was interesting about it was that on the last Computer America show that you did, it actually was covering a topic that you guys had talked about, and that was the Hand of the Thief bank Trojan that you guys had discussed.
Yep.
And so I was reading through it, and I posted the link to the excellent article, and I encourage everybody to read it. But what they said was that it was really not a very viable malware for Linux.
Oh, really? Yeah?
Yeah. So as I was reading through it, I don't take this the wrong way, but I didn't agree with the guest host on that show. He said that Linux wasn't quite as secure as we were making out, and you know, in a way I agree that nothing's 100%. I think Linux is right up there, or governments wouldn't use it, and I'm sure they wouldn't let the space shuttle run it if it was that fragile. What do you think?
Yeah, well, David Perry, the co-host on that episode, was just getting into Linux for the second time after a long break in between. So he made some very good points, and I think that the security in Linux is one of the areas where maybe we could have some disagreement, that's for sure. And it's one of those things that I think, especially when you're talking about Trojans, unless you take action to allow the infection to get onto your computer, it's not going to infect you.
Yeah. I come to that same conclusion, and let me make some observations, you know, because I re-listened to the Computer America and also did some research. First part, I want to do observations for when you're running Linux. A lot of the problems come when, one, people are running as root or super user all the time instead of, you know, actually creating an account. You know, they just log in. They like to, I'm running root. I can do anything. And we know that's
sure.
bad.
Yeah,
that's bad
yeah.
practice.
Even Windows doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah. Two, getting software other than the repositories or, well, like I say, questionable or shady sources. I mean, if you're going to get your software from a third party, at least know where you're getting it.
Yeah, at least check them out ahead of time, yeah.
Three, they don't keep their system updated. An example is, I don't know about you, but when I have done a new install for or on my Ubuntu or you, when you do Mint, isn't there usually security updates ready and waiting? Even if it was only out 2 days, it's already got security updates and fixes.
Yeah, pretty much. I think they base it on the latest RC release candidate, and then as long as there's nothing wrong with that latest release candidate, they change the name of the file and they release that. And of course, although it may have been 2 days since they released it and you downloaded it and installed it, it may be several more days since the release candidate was finalized. So it may be several days old, and there may indeed be some security updates that you need to apply, or maybe even some updates to applications in those few days that are there. This is the Linux world, and things go along pretty quickly.
One of the things I like about Linux is that they if something needs to be patched, they don't wait till a patch Tuesday or a patch, you know, right, Saturday, whatever. When they've got the patch and there's a vulnerability, since you have so many people looking at the code and the software, and you know, everybody's talking to each other, it's usually get the patches and fixes pretty quick. That's one of the things I would have to, you know, say if I was going to give anybody a leg up or saying that they're doing it right, I would have to say Linux would be the one that would win that round. So that's why it's always important to keep your system updated. You agree or disagree?
No, I agree. That's an important point.
Yeah, and then the last one, and I know this is a little piddly, but the people that don't have real good passwords, a god, user one, you know, whatever, they need to have a good, strong password. And also, before you type that long password in, hopefully with upper, lowercase, some numbers and a special character like a dollar sign, a pound sign, you know, or anything like that that's not in a dictionary, but actually look at what you're getting ready to do. Review the action before you type in your password and say, oh yeah, just go ahead, type password and go. On Windows 8, for example, all it does is, you know, it says, pops up and says, do you want to do this? And yeah, click, yeah, go ahead. You know, you don't even have to really read it. I encourage anybody that's running Linux, yes, and Windows and Mac and anybody else, that you look at the reason that you're typing in your password. Make sure that you understand this. I was surfing the internet on my Linux box the other day, and I had a screen pop up and says, you need to update your Windows Flash Player. That's the problem. I'm not running Windows.
Yeah. First clue.
Might not be the best thing to do. It just pops up. You know, I've actually had it pop up and say, you're infected, and it looks like a Windows Defender screen or antivirus. And I'm just like, there's a problem. I'm not running Windows, so I know it's not mine. Yeah. So you got to be real careful about that. And one of the things I believe that you suggested, and at the time, it didn't make much sense, but after sitting down, I'm like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense, is if you get one of those messages, don't upgrade it right then. Go to the site personally.
Yeah.
And check. You know, get your stuff from the site.
Yeah, go directly to the source rather than clicking on whatever that pop-up is telling you. As a Windows user, you see one of those, and it's a perfectly formed Windows Defender window, and it looks real, it looks legitimate, and as long as they didn't misspell something, you wouldn't be able to tell it from the real thing. And so it's probably a good idea just to close that window down. Of course, be careful how you do that, because closing the window might actually do something. So don't just click on the cancel button on the page, because that cancel button could be redirected to actually install something. Click the X to close the window, and then go to whatever your software updater is. In this case, we're talking about Windows Defender, and go see if there are any particular updates there or whatever the message is telling you. And if it's not, then I'd be checking around to see where that false pop-up may have come from. If you were on the internet, it could just be something that they're popping up from the website. But if it's if you're not, if you're just running your word processor or something and you're not really using the internet, then I'd be worried that maybe I already have an infection. And the same thing applies in Linux, of course. You know, if these malware writers are smart, they will stop using you know, fake Windows on Linux and make it look a little more like a Linux window, which is more difficult for them because unless they do a test to see what desktop environment you have and what theme you have applied and what colors, you know, what modifications you've made to that theme, they're going to have a hard time matching your window decorations.
Yeah, that tends to make sense. So, you know, just those few little things, I would say, would give you a hand up on your security. Like I said, I disagree with him. I think Linux is inherently more secure, but that's just me. I included some links from Microsoft's TechNet, showing that they actually wrote about the infection rates of all their operating systems, and it's actually a good read. I mean, because they talk about that the exploits have increased, and it's not just against in Microsoft or OS X; it's against Linux too. Nothing's 100%, but I really do believe that if I had to do some online banking, I'd feel a lot more comfortable running Linux than just running anything else. And that's just me. I mean, I do all my online banking under Linux, and I usually use a standalone copy, which I'll get all those people that are listening to stay and find out how I do that at the end of the show. Not that they can't forward it to the end, but maybe they'll continue listening.
Okay.
So anyway, before we move on, you got anything more to say about that?
Well, the only thing I want to say is just to underline the fact that although I would agree that Linux is more inherently secure than Windows, it is not immune from infection. It may be resistant to, and maybe you might even say immune to Windows viruses, those that target Windows because they're targeting Windows. But there is malware out there that targets Linux, and it could easily be expanded to even more kinds of malware. And of course, all the internet and browser-based stuff is possibly going to infect you regardless of what operating system you're on because it's targeting the browser. So just be careful out there.
Just before we end this topic, there was one last thing that just popped in my mind as you were saying that. He made a statement. His name was Dave Perry, right?
Yep.
Dave Perry said that Linux was harder to use than Windows, or something right along those lines. You had to be more knowledgeable or whatever. I disagree, and I'll give you two reasons. One, I don't worry near as much about catching something from the internet when I'm running Linux than I do with Windows, because there's just so much out there for Windows. But also, I have some older people that use Linux to just surf the web, send email to their grandchildren, stuff like that, that are completely oblivious to how Linux works, whatever. All they know is they hit the power button, they type in their password, and they're connected. They do their business. When they're done, they disconnect. They play their solitaire or whatever. And they've never once come to me and say, how do I open a command line? Or, you know, how much RAM do I have? Or do I need to worry about patches? And for years, they've just happily been computing without any intervention on my part, apart from updating their version when it was finally end of life. But other than that, it just ran perfectly for them. They never once looked command line. They never once had to worry about anything. They never caught viruses. They never, nothing ever happened. It just worked.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want for an average desktop computer user, an everyday user, is that the operating system gets out of the way. You don't even think about it. It just works. And with today's modern Linux distributions like Linux Mint and Ubuntu and various others as well, they're specifically designed to be used that way. And if you think back to what David Perry's experience was, it sounded to me from his discussions that he used Unix in the earlier days of his career. He used Linux a little bit in the 90s. And then his latest foray back into Linux to learn something a little more modern was the Raspberry Pi. And that device and the distributions of Linux that go along with it are designed for teaching people the guts of the hardware and the software. And so you do, as he observed, have to know what you're doing in order to make full use of it and understand what's going on. It's designed to work that way. But if you're using Ubuntu, you're using Linux Mint, you're using SolidX or K or any of the more modern Linux distributions that are out there, they're designed so that anybody can turn on the computer, as you said, put in your username and password, and start computing without having to think about any of the configuration of the system at all. It should just work, and it does just work. And so that's the state of affairs today. And I'm thinking that David Perry hasn't yet been exposed to that. Perhaps my discussion with him might have exposed him a little more to that, but we'll see. We'll see.
Send him a copy of Linux Mint and see if he changes his tune.
He'll try to install it on the Raspberry Pi, maybe.
Okay, Larry, so tell us what we're going to be talking about today.
Okay, today we're giving an introduction to open source licenses. So if you run Linux and you've had dealings with an open source project, you have already heard the term license. And in fact, if you used almost any software, heard the term license. But what is this license and how does that apply to open source? And how does it affect you? What does it allow you to do or not to do? We're going to cover all the basics around this, give you an idea of what all this means. And we'll also have an advanced episode where we'll get into why you would want to use one license over another. But for this episode, it's just an introduction, a survey, if you will, of what these licenses are, some of the names you might hear, and some high-level description of each.
Absolutely right. And since you're such a fan of definitions, I figured we'd start off with some definitions.
Okay.
And I went to opensource.org/licenses to get what the definition would be. And they wrote it so well, there was no way for the co-host here to improve upon it. So I basically copied and pasted, and it's so long, I think we just need to tag team this one if you're up to it.
Okay, so is this open source definition under an open source license so we can use it without
fear?
Yeah,
it
good.
Is.
Okay, so we'll just read it word for word. And I have to say, you out there listening, yeah, you with the earbuds in, Bill did all the research on this one, so I think he's done a good job. You be the judge at the end. I think this is great.
I don't know what he's talking about. I didn't do any research. send it all complaints and flames to LarryBushy@goinglinux.com.
Yeah, we don't have that email address, so it'll just go into the bit bucket. But that's okay. Anyway. So let's get into the definition. So first of all, open source. It doesn't just mean, I'll just read this. Introduction. Open source doesn't just mean access to the source code. The distribution terms of open source software must comply with the following criteria. And so we've got a list of, what is this, about 10 different criteria. Yeah, so let's just read through it. So one. Free redistribution. The license shall not restrict any party from selling or giving away the software as a component of an aggregate software distribution containing programs from several different sources. Don't worry, I'm going to translate this into real English in a minute. The license shall not require a royalty or other fee for such sale. So essentially, you can redistribute it for free. You can redistribute open source software as part of something else, and you can choose to charge for it or not. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me. And what's also just so everybody's like, wow, that's written kind of hard to understand. This is clear English compared to some of these licenses.
This is less legalese talk than most of them. So, okay, well, let's get into point number two, the source code. Mm-hmm. The program must include source code and must allow distribution in source code as well as compiled form. Where some form of product is not distributed with the source code, there must be a well-publicized means of obtaining the source code for no more than a reasonable reproduction cost, preferably. Downloading via the internet without charge. The source code must be the preferred form in which a programmer would modify the program. Deliberately obfuscating source code is not allowed. Intermediate forms such as the output of a preprocessor or translator are not allowed. So essentially, you have to provide the source code, all the source code, nothing but the source code. It has to be the actual source code, and the source code shouldn't be written in such a way that you're, as they say, obfuscating it. In other words, hiding what it actually does. Make it look like it does one thing when it's actually doing something else. So it has to be transparent to the programmer or the user what the program does.
Yeah, let me tell you how most of these projects are doing it, Larry. They'll include a link to a website where you can download source code off the internet. So the basics say, here's the license. You want to look at the source code. We didn't include it. But if you go to this website, you can download it 25 times for free. Knock yourself out. So that's basically what it says. Basically, you've got to let someone know where it is, make it easy and transparent to get, and you don't have to, you know, be able to read backwards in Latin, upside down, spin on your head.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, so this number two criterion also basically says that if you are distributing your software, you can give them the source code along with the software, or you can make it available, as you said, on the internet.
Yeah, as long as you make it available.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, the third point is called derived works. The license must allow modifications and derived works, and must allow them to be distributed under the same terms as the license of the original software. Basically, what this means is the license allows you to change it to your needs. You can do it, you know, do what you want. If you need it to be red and it's green, you can change it to red, and you can distribute it without any problems, as long as you leave the license the same.
Right. Well, the way I read that is, as long as you don't prevent somebody from redistributing it under the same license. So, for example, if you are, and we'll get into this when we're talking about some of these licenses, but if you have something that you've licensed under GPL3, you must make it so that you're not preventing somebody from redistributing under GPL3, which we'll find out GPL3 is a pretty restrictive license.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if you were to try to redistribute that under the Apache license, originally having it under GPL3, you probably couldn't do that. If you started with the Apache license, as long as you didn't prevent somebody from redistributing it via the Apache license, you're in compliance with this particular criterion. But that doesn't require that they distribute under the Apache license. If they took the Apache code and redistributed it under GPL2, GPL3, LGPL, any of these other licenses we're going to talk about, that would be okay as well, as long as you don't prevent them from redistributing the software under the original license of your software.
Okay, that makes sense. So basically, if you if it was released under the GPL version 2, and you made some changes, but changed the license type to whatever, as long as they could release it under the original license, it's not a problem.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Okay. Number 4, integrity of the author's source code. The license may restrict source code from being distributed in modified form only if the license allows the distribution of patch files with the source code for the purpose of modifying the program at build time. The license must explicitly permit distribution of software built from modified source code. License may require derived works to carry a different name or version number from the original software. So, basically, what's this mean, Larry?
Sure. The first part of this is saying that you can take your original source code and you can release it in its modified form. If you're taking somebody else's source code and modifying it, you can provide that modified software only if the original license allows you to distribute patch files with the source code, and those patch files have to be files that are used to modify the program when you build it. So you provide the original source code for the original program, and then you provide patches to modify it when you build it, so when you compile it, in other words. But you can only do that if the source, if the original license allows it.
Okay. But the original license might make you call it a different name, and you might also have to put a different version number to show the difference between the original and the modified.
Right. So this is what this is saying is the license can require you, if you do the modifications, to change the name or version number from the original software. It doesn't require that you do that, but it's saying that the license may require you to do that. Mm-hmm.
So basically, this clause of this license is basically protecting the author source code, but also protecting the people that are patching the software also.
Right. It's so that when somebody modifies your original work, that it doesn't get distributed as though it were your original work.
Okay. Well, right? That makes sense. So it's basically protecting you.
Yeah.
Okay, number 5, and I think this is a real important one, no discrimination against persons or groups. This license must not discriminate against any person or group of persons. Give you an example, say you're a political party and you needed a certain software. You could write software to fit your needs, and someone can't come in and say, I don't agree with what you're doing, so you can't use my software.
Right. What this is saying is you can't put that in the license. You can write the software that discriminates against other people, but you can't write the license so that you're making it available only to a certain group of people.
Well, yeah. So basically, you can't tell someone that they can't use your software just because you don't like the way they look, smell, political beliefs, religious beliefs, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
They can use your software, basically.
Right. You can't prevent them from doing that in the license.
And number 6 is along the same lines, but it's a different area. It's called no discrimination against fields of endeavor. The license must not restrict anyone from making use of the program in a specific field of endeavor. For example, if it may not restrict the program from being used in a business or being used for genetic research.
Right. Yeah, I think that's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
You have to allow, if your software is open source, you have to allow it to be used for any purpose.
So, there's, if the software is open source and say Larry Bushy wrote this great program and it's known that you don't agree with nuclear power, but I need that program that you wrote, I was going to use in my nuclear power research program, I can.
Yeah, I can't specify in the license that you can't use it because you're using it for a nuclear power project. Either that or I can't call it open source software because it doesn't meet this requirement.
Okay. By the way, I need your license because I'm working on a nuclear power plant, so I don't have to pay the electric company anymore.
Go for it. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
And when you're finished with that flux capacitor, I have a car I want to put it in.
Does it start with a D?
Yeah, it might. It might.
Oh, cool. All right.
All right. So criteria number 7, distribution of license. The rights attached to the program must apply to all to whom the program is redistributed without the need for execution of an additional license by those parties. In other words, your license has to stand on its own and it has to be transferable to whoever you're distributing that software to.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And number 8, license must not be specific to a product. So the details here, the rights attached to the program must not depend on the programs being part of a particular software distribution. If the program is extracted from the distribution and used or distributed within the terms of the program's license, all parties to whom the program is redistributed should have the same rights as those that are guaranteed in conjunction with the original software distribution. So you should be able to pull apart any part of a bigger project and use that piece standalone, provided that it is licensed under an open source license and that license follows that piece of software, and you can't make it a term of the license that people can't pull this thing apart.
That kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
9, the license must not place restrictions on other software that is distributed along with the licensed software. For example, the license must not insist that all other programs distributed on the same medium must be open source software. Basically, right. What this means is you can't say that everything has to be open source or everything has to be closed. Basically, you just can't tell other people what they must license their software under.
Yeah, and it goes a little bit further. It says that if you're licensing your software under open source software and that it is being redistributed along with other things, like, for example, if you've got VLC Media Player and it's being distributed with an MP3 file so that you can listen to it, your license can't say that all files being distributed with your product must be open source licensed. So you could actually have somebody take VLC, put it on a CD along with a bunch of MP3, a bunch of AAC, a bunch of proprietary licensed software or media files, videos or audio files, whatever it is. And your license under VLC can't say, oh, you can't distribute this if you're going to distribute it along with non-open source software, closed source software. So it actually extends to saying that you can't restrict what's distributed with your software within the license.
Number 10, license must be technologically neutral. No provision of the license may be predicated on any individual technology or style of interface. So let me just take a whack at this. This clause basically is telling me that the license can't rely on a certain technology, that it can be used on all technology that's open source. Is that right? Close?
Yeah, I think that's it. If you are using an open source license and you want to call your software open source, you can't say that your software must be used with something else of a particular style or technology as part of the license. So I think you got it, Bill.
Okay. You know, now that we've got through the 10 points and we want everybody to know we're not lawyers, so if we miss something, write in, let us know, and we'll correct it. But what I was going to ask you, Larry, is why do you think all this is important?
Well, it's important, and we'll get into it when we talk about why you would want to use one license over another. It's all important because what they're defining here is not a particular license, but what the license should and should not include if you want it to be an open source license. And as long as you're following these 10 points in defining what your license is, what your license terms are, you should be able to call your software open source. And so you may design your own license. Maybe you don't like the BSD license, or you may not like a couple of things around the BSD license you want to change, and you want to make the Bill Smith license, and you want to make a modification to one of the terms of the BSD license. As long as you follow these guidelines when defining your license, you should be okay, and you should be able to call it an open source license. But if you cross one of these lines, it's not open source by definition.
So basically, they're laying out the guidelines and the borders of what open source means. And as long as you are within these the borders, you're open source. So Larry, what are some of the most popular licenses out there today?
Okay, so how fast do you want me to read through the list? We could go Apache BSD, BSD2, GNU. No, let's take them a little slower than that, shall we? Okay. So, starting alphabetically, it looks like this list is alphabetical. There is the Apache license version 2. Now, Bill, you did the research on this. Is version 2 the current version and version 1 has been deprecated or obsoleted? Or is this just version 2 and you can still use version 1 as well?
As far as I was able to tell, Apache license version 2 is the version that's used today. I'll be able to tell you more about, you know, the differences in our advanced episode. But mm-hmm. right now, I just kind of want to give everybody an idea of the different licenses and maybe just a quick little overview of where they might be used. So okay. Right now, I'm going to say I don't know, but from what I understand, Apache license version 2 is the Apache license that's used.
Okay. And if you want to find out more about any of these licenses, we'll have a link to each one in our show notes. And when I click through the Apache license, it shows Apache license version 2, current, and then Apache license version 1.1, historic, 1.0, historic. And reading through the text here, it implies that, of course, you'll find things that are licensed with the older versions because they were created back in 2000 or earlier, the year 2000 or earlier, which is when version 1.1 was approved. And on the other hand, if you are licensing something today, you want to use version 2.0 because that's the current version, just like you said, Bill. Okay.
Yeah. The next one is called the BSD 3 Clause License, and don't ask, I'm still reading all these licenses, so don't ask me what the difference is of the one that you're getting ready to tell us about, which is
the BSD 2 Clause License. So we'll find out a little bit more about those in the advanced episode. Okay.
Yeah. After reading these, you know, I only can read them about an hour before my mind starts turning into oatmeal and I can't even talk.
Yeah.
The next one is the GNU, and we have all heard of this one, the General Public License, and it covers several different versions, and they are GPL version 2, GPL version 3, and of course their links are for each one and you can read it, but we'll get into that in our advanced episode. But what's next?
Okay, there's also something called an LGPL, the GNU Lesser General Public License, and they're on version 2.1 of that, and we'll have a link to that. And there's also a GNU Lesser Public License, LGPL version 3, available too.
Well, and my personal favorite is the MIT license.
Okay.
That's our next one.
It's got a short acronym. Is that why it's
well, not only is it a short acronym, it's one paragraph. It's what I call the use it and abuse it license.
Right. Use this for whatever we want to use it for.
Yeah. But Larry, now that, you know, this is not all of them, but this is the most popular ones from what I've been able to do for my research. Do you have one that you like or that you find interesting?
I'm not sure that I have a favorite. I have one that is my least favorite among the ones that is in the list we just read through.
And what's that?
That's the GPL version 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I figured that might be it.
That is for an open source license, and they would say this is not an open source license. This is a GNU license. Mm-hmm. This is probably, arguably, the most restrictive license in this list. Mm-hmm. It protects the four freedoms of the Free Software Foundation, but it specifically restricts your freedom of choice. So, ooh. Yeah. So it... because of that, I think it could not be considered an open source license. Hmm. It's a free software license, you know, because they're discriminating against someone's ability to use it for whatever purpose they want to use it for. Well, maybe not. They're discriminating against your ability to do certain things with the software that you are redistributing. In other words, in order to redistribute it, you must have it licensed under the GPL version 3, or any derivative works must be GPL version 3 licensed, from what I understand. And so that makes it my least favorite because it restricts some specific freedoms related to freedom of choice.
And all Flame Flame emails should go to steveballmer@microsoft.com.
They may not get to him because he's retired now. But that's no, okay.
Seriously, we're going to get into a lot of that in advance. And we were going to just do one episode, but after we started looking at it, we realized that we could actually do a month's worth of podcasts on this subject. So we decided that we're going to at least break it up into an introduction and advanced. And so a lot of what we're talking about will make sense once we've finished our advanced episode. But just to give you an idea of how much open source is used in commercial products, I did a little digging around, and Larry, I included a link which will be in the show notes, and it is all the open source that goes into OS X or the Mac operating system.
And, right.
Yeah, and that website is www.apple.com/open-source.
Yeah, it's quite a lengthy list as well, yeah. And there are some titles on here that you'll be familiar with. There'll be mm-hmm. Apache software. There's the, of course, CUPS software, open source software that, as I understand it, was originally developed by Apple. Mm-hmm. cron for cron jobs, you know, automating your timed bash scripts and things like that. And many others that you would find and not expect to see under a proprietary operating system like Mac OS X.
Yeah, so you get a chance, and you know, you need to get sleepy before you go to bed. Just go ahead and look down that list, and you'd be surprised on how much OS X uses and depends on open source.
Mm-hmm.
But how about this, Larry? What about LibreOffice? What is it licensed under?
LibreOffice is licensed under the L GPL. So ooh, that's the GNU Lesser General Public License. Okay. And again, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not an expert in these licenses, but the Apache OpenOffice, which LibreOffice and Apache OpenOffice both forked from the original OpenOffice that was under Sun and then was under Oracle before it was under Apache. And as I understand it, the Apache license that Apache OpenOffice is licensed under is more permissive than the LibreOffice license, the LGPL, which means that the folks at LibreOffice can incorporate anything that the Apache OpenOffice folks put into their software and put it into LibreOffice, but not the other way around.
Huh. Okay. Larry, have you ever heard of WordPress?
I have indeed. I took a look at it as possible software for hosting the Going Linux podcast.
Well, guess what? It's licensed under the GPL version 2.
Okay, I can live with that.
And the one of the most important parts of, or I say most important, I would say the most important part of the Linux project, the Linux kernel, is licensed under the GPL version 2.
Yeah, and I heard something about Linus Torvalds not wanting to change to the GPL version 3 for some of the same sorts of reasons that I talked about earlier.
Yeah, and we'll cover that. That will be a talking point in our advanced. It's rather interesting, and not that Linus is scared to let you know what he thinks, but he's got some interesting thoughts. We'll cover that. But, you know, Larry, what I'm really thinking is we need a good commercial PBX. We have anything licensed under?
Open source license? Yeah. Well, according to the show notes here, the Asterix PBS system is released under a dual license, the GPL, as a free software license and a proprietary software license as well, to permit licensees to distribute proprietary unpublished system components. It says here, originally designed for Linux, Asterisk also runs on a variety of different operating systems, including NetBSD, OpenBSD, FreeBSD, Mac OS X, and Solaris. Asterisk is small enough to run in an embedded environment like customer premise equipment hardware running OpenWRT. So, two licenses for the same software. Yeah. How's that work?
Well, we'll get into that. You know, I love throwing all these. You have to come back and listen next time to find out. But when you were looking through all the operating systems that Asterisk runs on, do you notice one that's not listed?
Doesn't say anything about Windows.
That's right.
Yeah.
It doesn't run on Windows that I know of. Now, they could, it could now, but I've just found out it's kind of interesting. The podcast that had used Asterisk a lot until I think they moved to a Mumble server was who, Larry?
The Linux Link Tech Show?
Yeah, you got it in one. So, basically, this is a full-blown PBX, and if anybody ever wants to see where you can spend some money, go look at commercial PBXs and prepare to have some sticker shock.
Yes, they are not cheap. Yeah, even those that use Asterisk in the background, you know, they are not cheap.
You're going to spend some money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, we're kind of coming to the end of our, what I call our cement ground basement here of show. And hopefully we've laid out enough to kind of get everybody's appetite whetted. And so when we start speaking, they don't think we're speaking in some like Klingon or something. So, Larry, do you have any software picks that you want to tell them about?
Yeah, I have some software that is actually not released yet. It will be part of Linux Mint 16. It is something that they are developing at the Linux Mint factory. Linux Mint team is developing this. It is called USB Stick Formatter. And yeah, so what this does is they've said that, let me just read from a post by Clem. We'll have a link in the show notes to this, segfault.linuxmint.com. It says Linux Mint was among the first distributions to feature read-write and TFS support. It moved to hybrid ISO images, which could be written to USB sticks, roughly at the same time as other distributions, and it was late in providing the XORR ISO 64-bit ISOs, which could be booted off EFI both via USB and DVD. So I'm presuming that they have that now. So Linux Mint 14 introduced Mint Stick, an improved version of USB Image Writer. Linux Mint 15 introduced Nemo Actions, so you could just right-click an ISO file and select Make Bootable USB Stick. That's something I didn't realize I had the capability of doing until I just read this. And with all that, writing an ISO to a USB stick became a breeze. One thing that was still far from being trivial, though, was reformatting the stick afterwards to use it to carry data. One had to struggle with the command line, gparted, or even GNOME disks, unmount the stick, wipe its partition table, create a new one, partition it, and reformat it again. That seems like a lot of work. So in Linux Mint 16, Mint Stick will also feature the ability to format USB sticks, and by formatting, we mean doing all of the tedious tasks mentioned above. So there's more to this, and you want to read the comments once you click through in our show notes, but they've got a screenshot of what the USB stick formatter looks like. It sounds to me like you could put your Linux distribution on a stick, but if you wanted to use it in persistent mode or use the rest of the stick, let's say you have an 8 GB stick and you're using under 2 GB for the ISO image, what do you do with the rest of the space? Well, this allows you to not have to go through multiple steps to recover that empty space so that you can use it for data. This allows you to format it and repartition that USB stick so that you can use that free space.
Awesome. That's
Yeah.
cool. All right. I have two picks. One's actually a site and software, and one's just software. First one would be www.pendrivelinux.com. We've covered this before, but with everybody talking about security these days and the last computer America, I thought we would give you options to have a truly secure or as secure portable operating system as possible. So check out pendrivelinux.com, and you can always carry around your own secure or as secure as you can make it Linux operating system on USB. The next one is UNetBootin', and we've also discussed this one. I've included the links to the SourceForge project page. But the one thing I wanted to point out is, yeah, I try a lot of different distributions, but the one that I keep coming back to, you know, when I fall back on one for something to, I know it's going to work, it's going to be fast, and I carry on a USB key is Ubuntu Studio. I like the project a lot. When I broke my Sabian the other week, I needed to get in and do some work, and of course I just booted into my handy dandy trusty Ubuntu Studio USB stick, and it works beautifully. The thing that you need to know about is to always use the latest UNetBootin', just because they're always making improvements to it. But also, since a lot of the new computers, my beast included, uses the new UEFI, is that the distro needs to also support it. And what if it does, the UNEP boot will write that little partition that allows it to boot and work on the new hardware. So I had just installed, I think it's 1304. I still got a few things to get set up, but UNEP boot worked beautifully. I had downloaded a DVD. I put it on my my flash or my USB flash drive, and now I'm walking around with Ubuntu Studio on my in my pocket, and I've used it several times. You know, turn off the computer, reboot it, and I'm into my my familiar desktop. I've got my files because it allows you Ubuntu, and I'm sure Mint would do the same thing. Would allows you to have persistent storage, so it's really really handy. A shout out to UNEP Bootin, but also a shout out to Ubuntu Studio. I love you guys. Keep up the good work. But anyway, that's my little rant for software. So, Larry, what is our next episode?
Okay, our next episode will be yet another listener feedback. So send in those comments and questions and voicemails and call our voicemail line. Until then, you can go to our articles and show notes at goinglinux.com, the website for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. If you want to support our efforts, please click the donate button while you're there on the site.
You can download our episodes directly from our website, or you can play them right from the show notes page. Or better still, go to subscribe.goinglinux.com to listen how to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a single episode.
You can send us your feedback. We'll play your audio files or voicemail messages on the show. Our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com, or you can call us on our voicemail line at 1-904-468-7889.
And remember that you can leave your topic suggestions on our forums in forum.goinglinux.com or participate in our Google Plus community. Look for Going Linux Podcast.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
73.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.